You're listening to Extinct, a podcast about dead things. I'm Alice Leggett. Together, we'll explore the stories of species that have existed over millions of years, from the earliest forms of life to those that died out more recently, as well as modern biodiversity loss and conservation initiatives. You're listening to Extinct. In this episode, we're talking about pterosaurs in Australia and delving into one of the most significant species, Ferrodraco. Ferrodraco lived in Australia during the Cretaceous period over 100 million years ago. This species, nicknamed Butch, was first discovered in Winton in 2017 and is the most complete pterosaur found in Australia. To tell us more about Ferrodraco, we have paleontologist and Curtin University PhD student Adele Pentland. Adele is supervised by Dr. Stephen Porripat, who also features on this podcast. Adele is known for her work on Australian pterosaurs and is part of the team that named and described Ferrodraco in 2019. In that year, Adele's work on Ferrodraco was featured in the top 100, published in the journal Scientific Reports. Adele, thanks so much for joining us. To start us off, how did you get into paleontology and what sparked your interest?
Yeah, so I've had a bit of an interesting path in that I really did like dinosaurs when I was a little kid. But if you ask any of my family members, Adele, what do you want to be when you grow up? Except for that one week where I wanted to be an Olympic pole vaulter, it was a vet. But I actually didn't get the marks I needed to get into vet science. When you love animals as a kid and people ask you what you want to be when you grow up, I feel like vet is the obvious one because you get to work with animals and help look after them. But it's hard to imagine how many different careers are out there as well. And even if I sort of knew people were paleontologists, I don't think it's something that I ever really seriously considered as a path for myself, probably until I was 22. Vets have it really tough as well. Like, we've had a bunch of vets out on placement with us and they have to deal with so much, especially people who give them a hard time and physically abuse them and verbally abuse them. But I think it's probably better that I'm on this path. I mean, I get to help run the farm as well, so I have 9 potty lambs at the moment and a calf, so I've definitely got cuddles whenever I want them and stuff. But I think what I loved was learning about animals, which is what I get to do as a paleontologist. It's just that all my animals are dead. And then if the bone gets broken, well, I just get the glue and I fix it.
Yeah, you can't really do that with like a dog so much.
No. I mean, you can, but it's not advised.
Oh gosh.
So I just did a Bachelor of Science at Monash University. I was swept away by Marianne Anderson, who takes the first year geology unit over there. I think she still does as well. Dr. Marianne Anderson, I should say. And yeah, I just sort of fell down this rabbit hole of geology. And then once Marianne got me into geology, we had a really fantastic lecturer at second year for sedimentary geology. And he snuck in like some paleontology as well, Dr. Chris Mays. And yeah, I thought I was going to do geophysics in third year. And then, I don't know, I just wasn't super into it. I was finding it a little bit difficult to get my head around some of the coursework, but paleontology was something that I was just naturally interested in. And when you sort of motivated that way, it just makes it a lot easier to sort of study and understand things. So, yeah, I actually did an honours project supervised by Chris Mays and another fella, Associate Professor Jeff Stillwell, and I was working on amber. So it was some of the first in-situ amber found in Australia. So really Jurassic Park, kind of spending many hours looking down the microscope, trying to find insects and other bits and pieces. So plant material, fossil fungi as well. And, yeah, once I finished that, I just kind of knew there was no going back. Like, I had gotten a taste of what it was like to be a paleontologist, and that's all I wanted to do, and that's all I've wanted to do since then, really.
Yeah, talking about the amber again really evokes the Jurassic Park thoughts. But further along that path, because pterosaurs have been a significant focus for you, what got you into pterosaurs?
So once I finished up doing my honours at Monash, I really wanted to try and find a job in paleontology, but there isn't a whole lot in Australia. And at the time, yeah, I was living in Melbourne, and I applied for a job as a curator at Kronosaurus Corner in Richmond, and I didn't get that. And then I applied for a job as a tour guide at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs, and it was like an 8-month contract. So I moved up there, and that was at the start of 2016. And as of this recording, it's mid-2023, and I still live in Winton now. So, yeah, what basically happened was Age of Dinosaurs knew I really wanted to do postgrad, so I wanted to do either a master's or a PhD. And because I had worked on amber and insects before, I was thinking maybe I could do something along those lines. I had basically written up my whole master's proposal for that, had supervisors lined up, and then a local grazier, Bob Elliott, he happened to discover the most complete pterosaur in all of Australia. And one of the founders of the Age of Dinosaurs Museum, David Elliott, gave me first dibs to work on the pterosaur. And at first, I kind of balked at it because we hadn't done a lot of vertebrate biology when I did my undergrad degree. So I was a little bit taken aback. I don't really know anything about vertebrates at all, pterosaurs, but my boyfriend, he's now my husband, he was just like, you can turn him down, but yeah, you're an idiot. And I was just like, shit, I hate it when you're right. And yeah, so I launched into that, and I was really fortunate. So the supervisors that I had lined up for that previous project, they remained on board with me and were super supportive. Everyone around me, including the team at Age of Dinosaurs, was super supportive. Like, Del, you don't know anything about vertebrates now, but we know that you'll figure it out. So yeah, really lucky that I was in the right place at the right time. And I just had like the best support team behind me as well, because you hear about some horror stories in academia as well about supervisors basically trying to steal their students' work. And I'm sure a lesser person would have sort of jumped on the opportunity to work on the pterosaur themselves. But Steve's obviously amazing, and we're good mates as well. And my other supervisor, who was on board at the time, still on my team, Professor Pat Rich, just, yeah, 100% backed me. And yeah, I'm just so lucky because I reached out to like a few people once I finished up my honours, and I didn't get first class honours. I actually got half mark off. And because of that one half a mark, there were quite a few people who just didn't want to borrow of me, said, without any publications, you're not a good enough student to be on my team. And I think that's one of the reasons why I enjoy working with Steve and Pat so much. And I really want to get a good result for them as well, because, yeah, I'm just super aware that I'm very lucky to have been given the opportunities that I've had.
So it's great to hear that you've got such supportive people behind you, particularly the folks at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs, who I've only ever heard wonderful things about. But yeah, no, it's wonderful to hear that you've had such amazing support behind you. And I guess it also sounds like working with vertebrates for the first time, it's a bit of a trial by fire, or I guess a trial by fossil. I don't know what the best expression
trial
is.
By bone.
Trial by bone, exactly. Yeah, it's a bit of a trial by bone. But speaking of those bones, for people who might not be familiar with pterosaurs, but what are they and were they common in Australia?
Yeah, so I guess some people will also call them pterodactyls, like call the whole group pterodactyls, which I kind of get, but it's not correct, strictly speaking, scientifically to do so. But when a little kid tells me that their favourite dinosaur is a flying dinosaur or a pterosaur, I still give them a high five. I'm like, yeah, you're on the right team. You just need to change your language. So pterosaurs are flying reptiles. They lived during the time of the dinosaurs. And, I mean, maybe it's toy manufacturers' fault. I don't know who to blame. But you buy a pack of toys and there's always going to be like one pterosaur in there, maybe Dimetrodon, which is not a dinosaur, and maybe a plesiosaur as well. So colloquially, dinosaur kind of encompasses just anything from the Mesozoic. But yeah, getting back to it, pterosaurs are winged reptiles. So they are different to dinosaurs. They have a different shaped pelvis, but obviously the big thing is that pterosaurs flew around and had wings, a bit more similar to bats, actually. So they had wings made out of a membrane of skin, and they were flying around before the first birds are taken to the sky. So birds, you look at them today, their wings are made up of their feathers, and if their flight feathers get damaged, then they can't fly. So I guess to look at it, a pterosaur is more like a reptile cross with a bat. But yeah, there's a couple of other differences as well. And they're actually really rare in the fossil record compared to dinosaurs. And the reason why pterosaurs are so rare is because their bones were hollow, which helped them fly, right? But hollow bones mean they get broken up really easily before they get fossilized, or even as fossils, they can be eroded very quickly. So they're hard to find, but they're found everywhere in the world. In Australia, the first pterosaur bones were published on in 1980.
Really recently then?
Yeah, really recently, especially when you consider that the first pterosaur bones published anywhere were published by old white fellas in the 18th century. So Australia has like a fair amount of catching up to do, which is why, yeah, I'm really keen to do my work and try and work out where they sit in the family tree, what different types we have here as well. And yeah, just try and get the word out there as well, because it's funny, you sometimes go to these paleontology conferences and you say you work on Australian fossils and some people kind of turn their nose up at you because it kind of has a reputation for being a bit shit. but we're finding lots of good stuff as well. There's definitely a lot of room for improvement anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it seems like every time I open the news, there seems to be a lot of discoveries coming out. So hopefully that perception is shifting, because there's very clearly a lot that just is there that we just might not know about yet. So yeah, hopefully that's shifting. But with the species that we're mainly focusing on today, can you tell us a bit about Ferrodraco? What did it look like? And how did its physical characteristics impact its behaviour and lifestyle?
Yeah, so Ferrodraco is sort of the whole reason why I started my PhD. It was that amazing specimen that Grazier Bob Elliott found in 2017. So before Bob had made that discovery, there were maybe, I think it was like 15 pterosaur bones known from the entire continent. And he went down to spray for weeds in one of the far creeks on his property, and he found parts of the jaw. He found, I think, a tooth and a few different bits of the wing bones as well. So in one fell swoop, he had found the most complete pterosaur in all of Australia. And he didn't realise it at the time, actually. He thought he had something different. But yeah, we eventually worked out that it was indeed a pterosaur. So it was actually something like Ornithochira simus, which might be familiar if anyone's watched Walking with Dinosaurs, or Tropignathus mesembrinus. So it's sort of in that family. Ferrodraco also has a wingspan of about 4 meters, so pretty massive compared to what we have flying around today, but by no means it's not a big pterosaur either. Some of the giants had wingspans of, conservative estimates place it at 10 metre. So, yeah, and then some of the bigger showboating wingspan estimates, sort of 16 metres, but I think that's exaggerating things. But, yeah, still absolute beast units flying around in the sky, and the largest animals to have ever flown on Earth. So, yeah, they're absolutely fascinating. Pterosaurs can vary quite a bit. My boy Butch had spike-shaped teeth, and he had a bit of a funny bump on the end of his nose, which we call a premaxillary crest and a dentary crest. And for a while, pterosaur experts would use the shape of the crest to define different species. Nowadays, we don't do that as much anymore, because the shape of that crest is probably a feature that changes between male and female, and it probably also changes in shape with age. But yeah, in terms of physical characteristics, it had quite long spike-shaped teeth. When the jaw was closed, they would have sort of meshed together. So imagine you've got your hands down in front of you and you just try and lace your fingers in between, or if you go to hold hands with someone, your fingers interlace with theirs. So that's sort of what the teeth are doing. They're hanging and sort of interlocking into place and helping this animal hold onto slippery fish that it probably would have eaten. And yeah, it would have just been flying around and probably eating them. I'd love to know if pterosaurs ate dinosaurs. I'm sure it had to happen at some point in the millions of years that they coexisted, but we don't have any direct evidence for that yet.
As you were describing that, I have been doing the hand thing and kind of picturing that. So for those listening at home, I think it really helps explain how this jaw worked if you actually do it. So a little bit like Play School when they get you to do the hand movements along with the TV. This is an interactive podcast we're listening to for sure.
Yeah, it's hard. I have to try and paint you a word picture.
Exactly. But speaking of this fossil in particular, it's Butch, right?
Yeah, it's Butch. So it's nicknamed after the mayor of Winton. So he passed away when Butch was found. So we decided to nickname it in his honour. And yeah, he was a great fella. And he actually had the nickname Butcher Bird, or Butch, as well. His name was Graham Thomas Lenton. But yeah, he was a big supporter of Australian native dinosaurs. First, like, A-grade mechanic as well, and mayor when he passed away. So it was really great to honour him with the find and the name.
I think it's really meaningful and lovely to name it after people who've been so supportive of paleontology. I think that's, you know, what an honour.
Yeah.
What a beautiful thing to be remembered for, absolutely. But what was it like working on Butch and analysing the fossil? And what sort of technology is also involved with that sort of process? Is it different when you're working with these hollow-boned specimens?
Yes. So with the Ferrodraco specimen, so the name means iron dragon because the fossil itself is sort of impregnated and the hollow cavities are filled with ironstone, this iron-rich rock. For one thing, the name hadn't been taken by some beetle or something, which has happened before with pterosaurs. And I just thought it was so fitting because without this ironstone rock, the bones probably wouldn't have survived and been around for Bob to find. So in terms of handling them, it wasn't too precarious. There were some bones. There was one bone in the wing and then the crest that I mentioned before. They had been broken up because the bone was quite thin. So the crest is only about a millimetre or 2 millimetres thick. It's pretty thin, despite the fact that it's quite a prominent feature on the end of the skull. And then, yeah, one of the other bones unfortunately got pancaked flat. So when we retrieved the wing bone from the field, in order to glue the 50 or 60 pieces of fragment together, Judy Elliott, one of the co-authors on the paper, and Bob Elliott's mum, she actually used matchsticks on the back to sort of reinforce and hold them together. But otherwise, handling the bones was pretty straightforward. So in terms of working on them, essentially you get the bones in front of you, you look at them, you make observations. You also want to compare what you're seeing with other related specimens as well and seeing what similarities and what differences there are as well and why there might be those differences. Is it taphonomic artifact, or has this bone been crushed before it was fossilized? So are you actually looking at maybe a hole or a depression that is true to form? So was that there when the animal was alive, or is that something that happened afterwards? And then photographing the specimens as well. And then obviously if you can get access to it, then synchrotron scanning, so some sort of three-dimensional scanning, is incredible because we know from the past, during World War II, the holotype specimen of Spinosaurus was lost forever during air raids. So if we can create digital models of our bones to preserve them for posterity in case the worst happens, then we've got that data backed up. So I was also able to get Ferrodraco scanned at the synchrotron in Melbourne. It's actually near Monash. And yeah, that was a pretty interesting experience because beam time is pretty expensive. So I think I just got a grant to do, I think, a day and a bit of scanning. And for the hours in the facilities, it's equivalent to about $32,000. So yeah, it's a bit competitive, but yeah, because it costs so much, they don't go just from 9 a.m. to 5 and then knock off. No, that facility runs all through the night. So it was really interesting being there with the person who was eye contact there. And I think he tried to sleep on maybe three office wheelie chairs just all lined up together.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm watching him do, like, line this up, and I'm like, surely he's going to fall off or something's going to go wrong. But no, he'd done it before, and he actually sent me home at, like, 3 a.m. in the morning because I was fading pretty fast. And thankfully, Mum and Dad's was just 20 minutes down the road, but still I took that drive pretty gently. At least the roads are nice and empty and the traffic wasn't bad.
It's peaceful to an extent, hey?
Yeah.
Once you had these scans done and everything, what sort of determinations did you make from actually analysing Butch?
So the scans were really helpful in that they told us what was happening inside the jaw, so we could see whether our replacement teeth were coming through and how that was happening as well, which we were then able to compare with other observations that pterosaur researchers before me had made. And yeah, it just kind of bolstered my other observations that I made as well about what the shape of the bones were like. And then we fed that information into basically like a big spreadsheet, but instead, to signify what the shapes of the bones were, we effectively entered in numbers instead of words. And then we did what's called a phylogenetic analysis. So essentially, we were trying to work out where Ferrodraco fit onto the pterosaur family tree by finding the path of least resistance, or it's known as parsimony. So how few changes can be made so that everything relates together.
Absolutely, kind of finding those commonalities. And I guess speaking of said commonalities, we were talking about this a little bit before, but how would you say Ferrodraco compares to other pterosaurs, with, you know, Australia not having much of a sample size to compare to, but both in Australia and overseas?
What was really interesting about the phylogenetic analysis is that because Ferrodraco had this crest, I was looking at Anhanguera and Tropignathus and specimens from South America, and I was like, oh yeah, it's going to fit into this group, no worries. But instead, those first results actually pulled Ferrodraco together with Ornithocaris simus from England, Mafunga camara from Australia, but it's a little bit older compared to Ferrodraco. So both Ferrodraco and Mafunga are found in the Eromanga Basin. Mafunga is known from the Tulabak Formation, and it was actually the first pterosaur species name from Australia, and it's sort of the middle section of a skull with the upper and the lower jaws fossilized together in one chunk. It's been really interesting continuing to work on Ferrodraco since we made the announcement of the species in 2019, because in the different iterations of the phylogenetic analyses that I've run, Ferrodraco and Mafunga, they're always together. And then the third one, if there's a third species that joins them, sometimes it's been Ornithocaris, sometimes it's been Tropignathus mesembrinus that I mentioned before, sometimes it's been another fourth Australian pterosaur, Tabunaga shorai. So yeah, it's interesting. The more pieces of the puzzle that you get, the clearer the picture becomes. But again, pterosaurs are as rare as hen's teeth, so it's always going to be changing, I guess.
That makes sense. And in terms of extinction events and when pterosaurs and species like Ferrodraco were around, how do you think they kind of fared in extinction events, you know, being flying reptiles as opposed to more terrestrial species that were around at the time?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I mean, pterosaurs popped up at the start of the Triassic and they were around until the end of the Cretaceous because of the mass extinction event there. So the group that Ferrodraco belongs to, they didn't make it to the end Cretaceous mass extinction event. And maybe one of the reasons why they didn't make it there is because during the Cretaceous, about 90 million years ago, there was the Cretaceous thermal maximum period, which was honestly a pretty tough time to be alive because there was global warming, the ocean surface sea temperatures had gone up, which was then affecting the acidification of the oceans and biomineralization, all these things that set off a cascade as well. So even if a lot of pterosaurs could fly, if their main food source for some groups is fish, they're still going to be impacted by mass extinction events. One of the questions that I would love to answer, and I don't know if we'll ever find out in my lifetime, is how similar is the wing membrane of a pterosaur to a bat? Because I've read somewhere that bats are really fast healers on the skin that makes up their wing, and I would love to know, are pterosaurs sort of in the same boat? What happens when that membrane gets ripped? But if you have a 10-kilometer-wide meteorite smacking into the Gulf of Mexico, sending debris and creating kilometer-tall tsunamis and all this stuff, you have to come down from the sky somewhere. You have to roost somewhere. You need to rest somewhere. And if you have bits of molten glass raining down from the sky, then your wing's probably going to get pretty wrecked.
Speaking of unanswered questions about Ferrodraco, is there more that you're hoping to explore further in the future? I mean, with Ferrodraco and with other pterosaurs that we just don't have the answers to at the moment?
Yeah, so with Ferrodraco, I would love to really get a solid answer of, is this a pterosaur that's truly terrestrial? Because it's from the Winton Formation, where we find lots of long-necked dinosaur sauropods, we find megaraptorids as well. So they look like the raptors from Jurassic Park. If we knew about Australovenator back in the late 80s, early 90s, I reckon it would have made it Jurassic Park. So there's no doubt about it. Winton Formation is pretty terrestrial. But in saying that, I was envisioning maybe trying to do some isotopic analysis of the Ferrodraco specimen to work out, is it fully in a freshwater system, or are we getting a bit of a marine influence? Is it potentially going off and flying to the Eromanga Sea as it's sort of starting to recede and then go back out towards the equator as we're losing that inland sea? Is it hunting in those waters, or is it just going in the rivers? I'm not sure if I'm really going to be able to answer that question, unfortunately, just because of the ironstone and the way that Ferrodraco is preserved. But the other things that I'd love to sort of explore in the future are, yeah, getting to new sites and then trying to work out, okay, so in the very few late Cretaceous fossil sites that we have here in Australia, do we have pterosaurs? Because I think we should. And what are they like, and how do they compare with other parts of Gondwana and other parts of the world as well? And there's a group I'd really love to find here in Australia called Tapaharids, and they are a type of pterosaur. They're a little bit smaller than Ferrodraco, actually. They've got wingspans of between 2 to 3 meters. They're still pretty massive, on par with a wedge-tailed eagle. And by all accounts, they should be somewhere in our Winton deposits. They're the right age rocks. So, yeah, I would love to find them. And we thought we had one at one point. I was working on a bone that had been found down in Victoria, and it had been identified as a pterosaur in their collections. And then once I sort of had done enough reading and had seen it enough times, I realized this can't be a pterosaur. And it actually turned out to be a new type of theropod dinosaur, which Steve and I described in 2020. The Elaphrosaurine, published in early 2020.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think the last question I have for you, Adele, speaking of bones and doing further study on Ferrodraco, do you think it's likely that you'll find more specimens to help answer these questions? Or do you think the circumstance of finding Ferrodraco in the ironstone means it might be a bit of a tricky find?
Honestly, like, the Winton Formation just continues to surprise and delight me. When we did the Ferrodraco dig in 2017 and we were excavating another site that Steve's working on, Steve Poropat, my supervisor, we just kind of went, gosh, it can't get any better. And then I think the year after that, we dug at a site and we found a bit of dinosaur skull, which was announced just very recently. And there's other parts of the Winton Formation closest to Isisford that have specimens and concretions. Potentially, we could find Ferrodraco in one of those concretions. But yeah, I mean, it's really hard because a lot of our sites in Winton, when we first identify them, we find a golf ball size or bigger chunk of dinosaur bone at the surface that's been sitting out in the elements for quite some time. So that's our first tip off, which is why we find so many sauropods. it's not because they're the most common dinosaurs out there. No, we know that basically every single sauropod site we've dug at, there have been teeth from Megaraptorids scavenging that carcass. We know from footprints at Lark Quarry, an incredible site, we should have heaps of tiny little chicken-sized, turkey-sized dinosaurs running around as well. And if you look around at the ecosystems we have today, you know that a lot of the biomass, a lot of the animals that are around, they're the little guys. They're things like insects and things like that. You don't have a whole swath of cow-sized animals and bigger without having these smaller species around too. So I really hope that we're going to continue to find stuff, but I'd be very surprised if Ferodraco is the only pterosaur to come out of the Winton Formation.
Yeah, surely. And I think that the Winton Formation sounds like it's a bit of a gold mine that's being slowly discovered. So Adele, it sounds like you've got a lot of really exciting work coming up, but what's kind of next on the horizon for you?
Yeah, so I've got a paper in press at the moment. So hopefully sometime this year it'll be published, which I'm really looking forward to. I've also been working on my podcast, Pals and Paleo, and yeah, just trying to do interviews for that. So I'm also going to try and get to the two Australian paleontology conferences on my horizons this year. One's in July in Perth and the other is in Melbourne in late November. So yeah, I'm really psyched to be sending emails out and trying to tee up interviews with some mates of mine as well who I haven't seen in ages, who I did undergrad with, and get them to tell me about fossils that I know they found in the field, and speak with people who just seem to be kicking goals and hear about their research. And yeah, potentially going over to Brazil as well. So I'll have to try and nail down some Brazilian paleontologists and get them to talk to me about what they work on.
That sounds super exciting. Very busy year. But where can people go to catch Pals and Paleo?
Yeah, so Pals and Paleo is available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all the major streaming platforms. And then if you want to see a bunch of dumb dinosaur memes from me as well, I can't compete with some of the big accounts, but I'll be posting some stuff like that to the Pals and Paleo Instagram page.
Fabulous. Well, I'm sure hopefully if people are listening to this podcast, I feel like people, if they've managed to get to this point, they'll definitely be interested in the Pals and Paleo content as well. So yeah, encourage anyone to jump on that train for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you've been able to put up with my voice for this long, much longer, and you actually want to hear more from me, then yeah, Pals and Paleo is your best next option.
Adele, it's been a delight having you on the show. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and yeah, always happy to chat. And if you're coming through the Winton area, let me know and we'll see if I can show you around.
You've been listening to Extinct. I'm Alice Leggett. If you want to hear more about dead things, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating or review. It helps Extinct reach more people who are passionate about the planet's past and future. Until next time, stay curious.